is Friday, May 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the state of Syria's revolution.
Revolutionary types, they're willing to go all out, and I think it's been demonstrated in the past couple of years that they are willing to kind of put their money where their mouth is.
We'll also look at South Sudan's food security, plus the controversy surrounding B.B. King's death. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A coalition of Syrian rebel fighters led by an al-Qaeda branch has taken over the last government-held city in the northwestern Idlib province bordering Turkey. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says Syrian forces pulled out of Araya Thursday after bitter fighting with the al-Fatah army. The number of casualties so far unclear. Al-Fatah is a rebel coalition led by the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front. Its chief, Abu Muhammad al-Ghalani, told Al Jazeera this week that it is focused on defeating Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and not on attacking the West. And for more on what's happening in Syria, we turn now to VOA's Jeffrey Young.
Philip Smythe is an author and a researcher at the University of Maryland, just published an article in Foreign Policy magazine stating that the regime of Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, and his benefactor in Iran are girding to build up a new opposition response. Mr. Smythe, in your estimation, does the Syrian government at this point, the government of Assad and Tehran, the government of Iran, do they have the wherewithal and the resolve to go after multiple points of attack at this point?
And I would say yes, they do, but it's a process which is going to take some time. It's been taking a lot of money, and it's also going to require even more foreign fighters, which Iran has been routing into the country.
We have a situation on Iran's side where Iran has poured tremendous resources into both Syria and into Iraq. It's trying to backstop both the government of Syria and the government of Iraq. It doesn't want to see either one of them fall. At what point does Iran's resources get stretched too thin to be effective?
Well, I think we need to understand this from the Iranian perspective. One, you have a leadership element, and I'm talking about the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, in addition to Ayatollah Khamenei, who is the supreme leader, and they are firmly committed to this. Revolutionary types, they're willing to go all out, and I think it's been demonstrated in the past couple of years that they are willing to kind of put their money where their mouth is, and they've been doing so. They've been committing all of their proxies. They've been hurting, I guess, the general kind of Islamic resistance narrative that they've tried to cast, particularly with Sunnis, because remember, Iran wishes to cast itself as leader of the entire Muslim world by, you know, backing these sectarian entities. So they're willing to go all out, and they're willing to just, you know, keep pushing forward. And I think they're going to continue doing this for many years to come if need be, or in the short term, at least many, many months.
So that people can properly understand, this is not a fight like a football game where you have two teams. Because in the situation of Syria, you have Syrian opposition trying to topple Bashar al-Assad. That's element number one. And element number two is the Islamic State. And both are working to topple Assad. So, in other words...
Well, there's also Jabhat al-Nusra, too, al-Qaeda's Syrian branch. So you have all these different elements technically trying to topple Assad, and then also going up against one another, sometimes in more peaceful forms, but usually more aggressive ones, in order to scrape as much power as they can.
Where do you see this going in 30 days, 60 days, 90 days? A stalemate? Or do you think that there really will be some kind of a breakthrough on the part of Assad and Iran?
I think for the interim period, what we're going to see with Iran and also with Bashar al-Assad is a kind of partial projection in some areas. I don't really think it's going to be kind of a wide-scale, large offensive on multiple fronts, but they're going to try to hold as much territory as humanly possible. And then from there, and it's going to probably take a little bit longer than this 30-day kind of interim period, and then, you know, project from there. So I think certain key strategic areas, namely south of Damascus, now that Palmyra has been taken by the Islamic State, they're going to have to press up against them. Kalimun, which is a hugely important district for Hezbollah, there are also going to be a number of counterattacks going on in that area. So I think we're going to see a lot of this going forward. But in terms of kind of a major offensive, we're going to probably have to wait for that.
Philip Smythe is an author and a researcher at the University of Maryland.
Many thanks to you, Jeff. That is VOA's Jeffrey Young reporting. Also in the news, Iraqi security officials say two car bombs exploded at two five-star hotels in Baghdad, killing at least 10. First explosion occurred in the parking lot of the Babylon Hotel late Thursday, killing six people, wounding 14 others. Then moments later, another car bomb exploded outside a former Sheraton hotel, killing four people and wounding 13. Nobody claimed responsibility, but Iraq is seeing almost daily attacks that have been frequently claimed by the Islamic State militants. It's time now for Michael Lippin's look at what's happening in the world of social media.
Thanks, Steve. I'd like to draw the attention of our listeners to an exclusive VOA interview with Iraq's president, Kurdish politician Fuad Masum. VOA reporter Ali Javanmardi met with Mr. Masum this week in Baghdad and asked about Iraq's strategy for combating the Islamic State group. Excerpts of that interview were published today on our website, and I can tell you that the Iraqi president discussed the state of his army and the roles of the United States and Iran in supporting Iraqi government forces. We tweeted a link to that interview on our main Twitter account, at VOA News, highlighting one particular quote from President Masum, who said Iraq will fight the Islamic State, or ISIS, until they are killed or we die. That quote drew some mixed responses on Twitter. Let me give you a sample. Twitter user Azad Kurdistan doesn't think Iraq can win such a fight, saying, okay, so bye-bye Iraq then. Another skeptical comment comes from Saba Alani, who writes that a fight to the death wouldn't happen because the Iraqi army will run away. President Masum did get some encouragement, though. A user who goes by the name Shia Superpower said Allah is with you and expressed hope that with the help of Iran and Shiite militias, Iraq will regain each part of its country. And then we have user Sanaria the Rose saying that killing off ISIS will definitely happen because all the Iraqi people are brave. If you'd like to share your thoughts, reply to our tweet on the story or leave a comment for us at the bottom of the article on our website. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, Michael. If you find yourself on Twitter joining in on the conversation about what's happening in the news, you should look up Michael Lippin. His Twitter ID is @Michael_Lippin. I'm also on Twitter @VOA Norman.
I'm Nilar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
It's now estimated that 40% of South Sudan's population, or 4.6 million people, face acute hunger in the next few months. World Food Program says food insecurity is growing worse both in conflict and non-conflict areas. VOA's Joe DiCapua has our report.
The WFP says hunger is reaching record levels in South Sudan. Spokesman George Femenian says a combination of problems is to blame.
South Sudan is facing the worst levels of food insecurity the young country has faced since independence because of conflict, high food prices, and a worsening economic crisis.
The warning follows the release of the latest Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Analysis. The IPC is a scale that weighs food security, nutrition, and livelihood data to determine the severity of a food crisis. It was first developed for Somalia. It says that unrelenting conflict and the onset of the lean season, when food needs are the highest, are intensifying alarming levels of hunger in much of the country.
The latest analysis shows that the bulk of these people who are facing these high levels of food insecurity in the conflict-affected states of the greater Upper Nile. We're talking about Unity, Upper Nile State, and Jonglei State.
Conflict is also making food insecurity worse in northern Bahr el-Ghazal and Warrap states. Aid agencies are using airdrops, boats, food distributions, and cash vouchers to try to deal with the situation.
The World Food Program and its partners have been working flat out for months now, trying to ensure that we can provide food assistance to those who are in need. And we are continuing in this way. In the conflict-affected areas, we've been ensuring a regular supply of life-saving food assistance through our rapid response missions in particular.
Fominion says despite the efforts, humanitarian workers are having a harder time reaching those in need.
The renewed hostilities and the increased insecurity and intensifying harassment of humanitarian workers means that we are facing what we call shrinking humanitarian space available for us to work.
The World Food Program says it's facing a $230 million shortfall over the next 6 months. But even if the money is received, can aid agencies overcome the obstacles they face?
That's a very good question, because South Sudan is a very challenging area for humanitarian operations because of infrastructure difficulties which we face. The logistics operation here is quite heavy. If we don't have money in good time, we may not be able to procure in time. And once you're not able to procure in time, it becomes even much more complicated to move the food into the country.
He says the rainy season has begun, and in the coming months, many parts of the country will become inaccessible by road. Transporting supplies by truck is the cheapest method. Airdrops are the most expensive. Fominion says a return to peace is essential, not only for humanitarian operations, but for people to return to their livelihoods. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Also in the news, Libyan tribal leaders wrapped up a four-day meeting Thursday in Cairo by announcing the creation of a unified council to help find a solution to that strife-torn country. Tribal representative Abdel Matloub Al-Abayed said the council's aim would be to give support to the legitimate authorities in Libya, as he put it, a reference to the internationally recognized government based in the eastern city of Tobruk. Another tribal figure, that is, Abdelkader Belkier, called on Libyans to rally around the armed forces and confront terrorism. Since longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi was toppled and killed in 2011, battle-hardened former rebel groups armed with heavy weapons have been carving out their own regions inside of Libya. Still ahead here on The Voice of America, an update of world news with Ray Kugel. This is International Edition. I'm Steve Norman in Washington.
Here are the headlines from VOA. FIFA President Sepp Blatter says the corruption investigations into the practices of the football governing body brought shame and humiliation to the sport, but in his words, it is necessary to begin to restore trust. Two major European football associations called on Blatter to resign before FIFA presidential elections planned for today, but Blatter has refused. Iraqi security officials say two car bombings exploded at two five-star hotels in Baghdad, killing at least 10 people. The first struck at the Babylon Hotel late Thursday, killing six. Moments later, another car bomb exploded outside a former Sheraton hotel, killing four. A coalition of Syrian rebel fighters led by an al-Qaeda branch took over the last government-held city in northwestern Idlib province bordering Turkey. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says Syrian forces pulled out of Areha Thursday after bitter fighting with the al-Fateh army. The number of casualties unclear. I'm Ray Kugel, VOA News.
This This is International Edition. We're coming to you on the Voice of America. It's time now for another one of our ongoing series looking into the cyber world. Here's my colleague Susan Yockey.
Much has been written over the years about the necessity of computer users to be proactive if they want to guard their privacy and keep their machines clean of viruses. But as the use of mobile phones and other devices has skyrocketed, surveys show that users have often failed to transfer these precautions to the mobile digital environment, leaving millions vulnerable. Well, VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard is here, and he's got that look. Doug,
hi, Susan.
I think I hear another cyber scolding coming from you.
You know, every time I come in here, it feels like I'm hectoring you, you know, talking about web hygiene. But, you know, these things are obviously important. Running antivirus, keeping your programs updated, good passwords, that sort of thing. The problem is that people have failed to take those practices into the mobile environment where, you know, increasingly we spend a lot of our digital lives. So it's just more important than ever to learn some techniques about how to guard your mobile phone and your tablet.
So how do we do that?
Well, the first best place to start is with the device itself. So if you look at phones, the three most popular operating systems, Google Android, Apple's iOS, and the Microsoft Windows Phone, they all now offer encryption as default. Now, you don't have to encrypt your phone, but I would strongly recommend people consider encrypting their phone. Basically, what that means is you create some kind of passcode, and all the information in your phone, all your pictures, your contacts, all that stuff, is encrypted. You put the passcode in, you can get it. But if somebody steals your phone, and they don't have that passcode, they can't get it either. They can't get into it. It really is permanently locked. So it's a good first place to start, I think.
Well, you know, I'm kind of not really good with a computer. You know that.
I don't know that I would say it that way.
Is this going to be hard for somebody who's a dunce like me to do?
It's not hard, but I think the key thing is you can't have a very easy passcode like 123. That's meaningless. But also, it has to be a passcode that's not so complex that you can actually remember it. So somewhere in the middle there, you can find a middle ground, I think.
And you're going to tell me don't write it down.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Don't write it down.
Well,
you've been listening.
Yes, I have. Every time you tell me that. So is encrypting the phone enough?
No. Let's go the next space to actually how you connect in that mobile environment. Many people are familiar and use what's called Wi-Fi. You know, you're out at a shop or a mall or that kind of thing, and you open your phone, and it will appear on your phone. Oh, there are networks available. You can use Wi-Fi, but you're strongly recommended not to use what are called free open networks. Very often, I think even McDonald's offers this now in my neighborhood. It's a free open network. Anybody with a mobile can just hop right on without a passcode. The problem is those systems are so incredibly insecure that anybody in that open network can, if you're on it, it doesn't take much at all. They can pop into your phone, they can snoop around, they can delete files, they can put in malware. So if you're going to connect in a mobile environment, don't use that open free Wi-Fi unless it's absolutely necessary.
Are people not being more careful because they're lazy, or why aren't they not watching themselves?
I think they're being less careful because they're simply really not aware. You know, you pop onto a network, an open network, and you see how convenient it is. You can get directions, you can go to Yelp, do whatever you want. But what they're not seeing is how easy it is also for the bad guys to use those open networks to get into your phone or your tablet and, you know, create all kinds of havoc.
Well, I'm glad you're not a bad guy.
Not yet.
It would scare me with all your knowledge. Okay, thank you very much. That's VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard right here in our Washington studios.
Thank you, Susan. VOA's Susan Yockey speaking with Doug Bernard. Fun, but a serious matter nonetheless. For years, there have been allegations that football's world governing body, known as FIFA, did not play by the rules. So this week's massive corruption indictment against 9 FIFA officials and 5 corporate executives comes as little shock to many observers. It was the U.S. Justice Department, the FBI, and IRS that uncovered racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering conspiracies, among other things. VOA's Park Brewer has more.
This really is the World Cup of fraud. And today we are issuing FIFA a red card.
Pointed words Wednesday from Richard Weber, head of the Internal Revenue Service criminal investigation looking into U.S. tax evasion charges. Critics say for an organization that promotes fair play, FIFA needs to take a hard look at itself. Michael Cohn, president of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington, told VOA he is not surprised by the Justice Department's actions because of the large sums of money and fraud involved.
The evidence is apparently overwhelming, and you will get the word out around the world that if you engage in fraud on this type of scale, the long reach of the American laws will get you.
Russian President Vladimir Putin, whose country will host FIFA's 2018 World Cup, accused the United States of meddling outside its jurisdiction.
Those officials are not U.S. citizens, and if some event indeed happened, then it happened not on the United States territory, and the U.S. has nothing to do with that. This is yet another blatant attempt to extend its jurisdiction to other states.
FIFA voted Russia as host at the same session Qatar, a nation with not even one suitable stadium, was selected to host the 2022 World Cup. Because the favored United States finished a distant second in the voting to Qatar, soccer writer Ivis Galarsip told VOA via Skype, there's no doubt that raised red flags.
From a governmental standpoint, I think there was more notice paid, more attention paid to that campaign than any before it. So once Qatar of all countries won it, I think it was hard not to look at that. It was hard to ignore that and say everything's above board.
The alleged schemes even include the bidding process for the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. South African sports minister Fikile Mbalula says it's all speculation, and his country denies any corruption and bribery.
We however say to the American government, we will follow up on the matter through the diplomatic channels, which we have activated through the Ministry of International Relations and Cooperation, to establish the indictment of how South Africa is implicated.
The storm clouds over FIFA will continue to build, and more arrests are possible. Park Brewer, VOA News, Washington.
This is BizBeat.
One of the largest cities in the U.S., Los Angeles, plans to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, phased in over 5 years. At the American Enterprise Institute, economist Aparna Mirtha says studies show mandating higher wages can hurt some workers.
They actually find minimum wage hikes were associated with a loss in jobs for low-skilled workers.
Mandated minimums do not guarantee job creation. Lots of countries with minimum wages experience high unemployment, especially among the youth. But for the working poor, higher wages can mean a higher standard of living.
I've been working 40, 50 hours, and I could barely pay my rent. I have to, depending on government assistance, to get some food to eat.
Though each country has different labor laws, in this global economy, businesses are freer than ever to travel the world to find those willing to work for less. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
Yep, now it's time for the latest from the VOA Music Department.
Now it is 3 o'clock in the morning. Can't even close my eyes.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dave Bird. Thousands of fans and mourners jammed Beale Street in Memphis, Tennessee this week to pay respects to blues legend B.B. King. The 89-year-old guitarist and singer died May 14th, but how he died has become a source of some controversy. To find out more, VOA's Ray McDonald joins us in the studio. Ray, what is this controversy about?
Well, you know, about 30 years ago, Cyndi Lauper had a minor hit single with a song called Money Changes Everything. And I think it's one of the most honest songs ever made, because money does change everything, especially when you have a legendary musician like B.B. King. B.B. passed away on May 14th at age 89. He'd struggled with diabetes for years. He suffered a series of small strokes. Now, even before he died, his two daughters, Patty King and Karen Williams, wanted police to investigate his manager, Laverne Tony, and Tony's assistant, Myron Johnson. They were saying that these two men were neglecting and abusing B.B. King. And immediately after his death, they accused Tony and Johnson of poisoning him.
Now, I saw an article that said that one of the reasons they've brought this dispute is because B.B. King didn't leave them very much money. He left them like $4,000 or $5,000 each.
He left them $3,000 and $5,000.
Yeah, and the rest went to an educational foundation that he founded.
Right, right. B.B. King lost his parents at an early age, and he was forced to fend for himself, and so his own education was curtailed. And so he has set up the bulk of his estate to take care of college expenses for his family.
A second autopsy has been done on his body, but it will take a while to get the results of that, won't it?
It's going to take 6 to 8 weeks. Now, initially it was reported that the Las Vegas police were investigating BB's death as a homicide. They say not yet. They will not move forward with any investigation unless the coroner determines that King's death arose from unusual circumstances. So it's going to take us a couple months to clear this up.
Do you think this is going to tarnish the memory people will have of B.B. King at all?
I don't. I really don't. I think his decades of music and performing all over the world are definitely going to outlive this very short-lived controversy.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. We invite your commentary on this. You can log on to our website, www.voanews.com. Be sure to listen for Ray's Top 5 Countdown every week as well. If you don't hear it on the radio, you can hear it on our website. Again, that's voanews.com.
And the California property that once was Michael Jackson's home being listed for $100 million, according to the Wall Street Journal. It has been in limbo since Jackson's death. That was back in 2009. Joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The first democratically elected president of Tunisia since the revolution of 2011, Beji Caid Essebsi, visited Washington recently along with members of his cabinet and Tunisia's parliament, and met with senior U.S. officials, including President Barack Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, and the Secretaries of Commerce, Defense, Treasury, and State. The visit highlights the importance of U.S.-Tunisia relations as Tunisia continues its journey of democratic transformation, which, since 2011, has included a revolution ousting a long-term dictator, multiple free and fair elections, and the crafting of a new constitution rooted in the rule of law and recognition of the human rights of all people, including women and minorities. Secretary of State John Kerry noted that what has occurred in Tunisia in the last 4 years sends the world an important message, that democratic institutions, while sometimes difficult in the transition, can succeed when they have courageous leadership and when they have compromise. On May 20th, with President Caid Essebsi in attendance, Secretary Kerry and Tunisian Minister Advisor for Political Affairs Mohsen Marzouk signed a memorandum of understanding between the United States and Tunisia, spelling out the wide range of bilateral cooperation and programs, including economic development, security, and people-to-people ties. Secretary Kerry said the memorandum makes clear U.S. support for Tunisia's democratic transition and will bolster a country leadership team that has really been steadfast in its support of Tunisia's remarkable democratic progress. On May 21st, President Obama and President Caid Essebsi released a joint opinion piece in the Washington Post newspaper. In it, the two leaders said that Tunisia shows that democracy is not only possible, but also necessary in North Africa and the Middle East, proving that democracy and Islam can thrive together. They noted that since 2011, the United States has committed nearly $700 million and supported two major loan guarantees to help Tunisians pursue critical political, economic, and security reforms. After decades of dictatorship and several years of transition, wrote Presidents Obama and Caid Essebsi, Tunisians have won their freedom and democracy. The road ahead will not be easy, the two leaders warned. But as Tunisians seek to build the Arab world's newest democracy, they will continue to have a strong friend and partner in the world's oldest democracy, the United States of America.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
for